and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. When a society goes through a revolutionary transformation, it's usually described in political terms. How the composition or form of government changes, what happens to the political power of different groups within society. What gets much less attention is culture, as in art, music, film, literature, and other creative and intellectual endeavors and achievements. The question for today is, what did the Cuban Revolution do to culture in Cuba? How was cultural work harnessed to the project of building a new society? And if culture is viewed and treated in certain ways in capitalist nations, how has culture in Cuba after Fidel Castro and his comrades took power in 1959, how has culture in Cuba differed? In what ways was it, and is it, distinctive and perhaps revolutionary in its own right? In her new book, Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt writes that the ambition to eradicate the gap between art and society has been realized to a great extent in Cuba. Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt is founder of and researcher at the Center for Cultural Change in Kent in the UK, and her book is called To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. When Rebecca joined me in studio, I began by asking her about the social and economic conditions in Cuba in the 1950s, that is, in the decade before the revolution.
Well, as many listeners will know, Cuba had been taken by force by General Fulgencio Batista in 1952, and he had previously served as elected president of Cuba, but when he came back, he enacted a much more militaristic regime. And he was aided and abetted by the United States in upholding this regime. And he concentrated the resources amongst a very small elite within Havana. So education, culture, and material resources were all reserved for this tiny elite minority. So although there were fairly good indicators if you took the literacy or the health of the population as a whole, when you started to break it down, it was very clear that great inequalities existed between urban and rural areas and also within urban areas, particularly in Havana. And beyond that, if we're thinking about the culture of the revolution, many artists were excluded from participating in this elite situation and were denied access to the resources to make their work and distribute their work. And artists were getting fairly disgruntled by all of this. So at the time of the insurrection, which began in 1953, artists were already starting to think about how they might bridge the gap between themselves and the wider population because they weren't happy with this kind of elite situation.
What links were made between culture and education by people like Fidel Castro in the years before 1959?
Well, right from the word go, just in the aftermath of this insurrection that I mentioned, he was tried for his part in attacks on two army barracks, and in his first defense speech at that trial, which became known as History Will Absolve Me, he started to talk about his political program, and in that he made a very clear indication that education would form a part of that. A couple of years later, when himself and Raúl Castro and others were exiled in Mexico and began really planning the insurrection, they started to think more clearly about what that might mean, and the insurgent movement, which now was known as the 26th of July movement, put out a manifesto in which they articulated a desire for the extension of culture to the furthest corner of the island, preceded by reforms in education. So education and culture were very closely linked very early on within the revolutionary program.
What's your sense of the degree to which culture was emphasized and honored in Cuba pre-1959, in general, as a whole?
Well, I think the nation of Cuba didn't really have much say. It wasn't a very democratic society. As I've said, the culture was confined to this elite minority. It was very monetary orientated, very commercial. So entrepreneurs would be commissioning artwork. There wasn't really a sort of public sector, as we would understand it, in terms of state support for the arts. So there was a lot of disconnection between the artists, the people, and those who had access to culture.
Tell us about the cultural society called Nuestro Tiempo that was founded in 1951.
Well, this very much came out of the sense of disconnection between artists and the people. Initially, it was a core group of musicians who founded the society, and very quickly, artists and writers started to collect around them. Initially, they were concentrating on their aesthetic practice. Several members of Nuestro Tiempo were members of the Communist Party. And after the attacks on the army barracks in 1953, members of the Communist Party decided that they would step up their activity in the ideological field. And Nuestro Tiempo provided the perfect format for that because artists within the society were already politicizing themselves. They were enacting creative resistance against the dictatorship. And so it made perfect sense for these groups to come together. There were many interconnections already through artists and writers who were members of the party. But the sort of wider cultural machinery around the party started to get more involved with this society and started to try and orientate them a bit more politically.
Did Nuestro Tiempo have to operate underground given the repression of the dictatorship?
To a large extent it did, yes. And to be a party member in those days wasn't something that was actively discussed. Certain members of the society were certainly subject to repression. So there are stories of Batista's underground police coming in and seizing copies of books from members of the society. Permissions to travel were withheld, so artists couldn't move freely in and out of the country. There were various different acts of repression that were enacted against the members of the society, yes.
So when Fidel Castro and his revolutionary comrades, when they took power in Cuba in 1959, did they consider themselves Marxists or communists?
No, the revolution wasn't fought on a Marxist platform. It was a movement of national liberation to regain the national sovereignty from the neo-colonial relationship that existed between the United States and Cuba, which had been preceded by centuries of colonial rule by the Spanish. So Cuba hadn't, in fact, enjoyed its own national sovereignty for quite some time. And that was really the platform on which the revolution was fought. But there were those within the leadership who had an understanding of Marxism, who'd read the key texts of Marxism. And that sort of emphasis began to find its way into the revolutionary milieu in the immediate aftermath of the triumph of the revolution. But having said that, the actual explicit nature of the program wasn't made clear until spring 1961. So that's when the government started to become much more explicit that the program was actually socialist, although those who'd been observing it before were able to see that it was clearly socialist in its orientation. But it was actually a final act of aggression on the part of the United States that drove Cuba into the socialist and Soviet ambit.
And that was the Bay of Pigs.
Indeed, yeah.
So what did Fidel Castro say about the importance and relevance of culture and art to the revolution?
Well, Fidel himself was more interested in sport, but he understood from his comrades that culture was an integral part of the new society that they were trying to build. So when it came to actually dealing with culture, he delegated it to those who knew better than he did in that field. But at the same time, he firmly embraced the idea that culture was central to the society that they were building. He talked about returning art to the people. When we think about the pre-revolutionary era that I've described, which was very elitist, there was a very clear and conscious decision taken to disband that kind of elitist mentality, to break down the barriers between the urban and rural areas, to bring literacy to the people, to bring culture to the people. That formed very clearly a part of their early program.
Give us some details about the literacy campaign that Castro and his comrades instituted soon after they took power.
Well, in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, so as soon as the revolution had triumphed, Che Guevara was actually instrumental in teaching all the comrades who'd fought alongside him to read. And then slowly, slowly, that program was extended. And in 1961, Fidel Castro gave a speech at the United Nations saying that within a year they would eradicate all illiteracy on the island. And the way in which they did that was that they called for volunteers. 250,000 people came forward, around 100,000 of whom were young people, teenagers, many of whom were women. And they went out into the countryside and taught the peasant population to read in a sensational program that means that Cuba has the highest literacy rate in the world today, either the first or second highest in the world today.
And this literacy campaign, I mean, to what extent has it been identified as embodying or symbolizing the kind of energy that the revolution both contained and unleashed?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are important to mention. One is that young people who had been too young to play a part in the Revolutionary War suddenly had a role within revolutionary society, which was fantastically important in terms of giving them a place within society, making them feel involved, and changing their consciousness. There's a fantastic film that's just came out a while ago by Catherine Murphy. It's called Maestra, which has a double meaning. It refers both to the mountains in which the insurrection was fought, but also means teacher. And she documents the literacy campaign. She has fantastic archival footage, but she also interviews many of the women specifically who took part in the literacy program and asks them about their experiences. And this really conveys the idea that it was an emancipatory thing for them. Many of them were young and they had to try and negotiate permission from their parents to go out, leave home for the first time and get involved in this program. And you can really see many of them trace their empowerment and their time within society to that point of the literacy program. So that was one of the most important things. And on an international level, it was such a high-profile project. The fact that Fidel announced it at the United Nations and the whole world was aware of what they were doing was a very clear signal on the international stage that they wanted to democratize access to everything.
That's the voice of Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt. She joins me on Against the Grain. Rebecca is founder and researcher of the Centre for Cultural Change in Kent in the UK, and she's author of To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. A lot of resources, as I understand it, were also devoted to training teachers and setting up schools.
Yes, that's right. So in the immediate aftermath of the literacy campaign, you have this newly literate population, many of whom hadn't had access to education before, and some of whom took up places at schools. But many of the people who were taught to read during the literacy campaign were actually beyond school age. So this refers mainly to the people who had served as brigadistas within the literacy campaign. Many of them entered the school system. Some of them were already at university. Budgets for schools were increased tenfold, and schools were built and renovated all around the island to make sure that there was a system in which people could be educated, right from primary through to university-level education. It's important to mention also that when we think about the relationship between education and culture, many of the people who'd served as brigadistas during the literacy campaign were retrained as arts teachers. Tens of thousands of these arts teachers were trained up and took their skills out into the population, initially in factories and farms and other workplaces. And in the heyday of this program, which became known as the Aficionados program, there was around 1 million amateur artists practicing in a population of around 6 or 7 million. And by the same token, art schools were opened up, fantastic international quality art schools in Havana and throughout the rest of the island.
Yeah, and this training of art teachers by the thousands, this was part of an effort, as you write, to bring art to the people. And so how much of the cultural project of Cuba was about sort of breaking down the barriers between art and artists and people and society?
Yes, just to be a bit pedantic there, the actual ethos was bringing the people to art rather than art to the people. So it wasn't this kind of top-down mechanism by which art was inflicted upon the people. The idea was very much that the people would be encouraged to access art in whichever way possible. So there was a huge network of museums and galleries that was built up and renovated, and people were encouraged to visit exhibitions of art that had been requisitioned from the previous regime, new art that was being produced by people within the country. But then Fidel invoked the transition from spectators to creators, and the idea was that art would be made available not just as a passive spectatorship exercise, but as a very active participatory way of producing creative stuff oneself. And so within the capitalist world, we tend to think of there being this great separation between art and the people. That's almost a deliberate and conscious thing that we can trace through history. But in Cuba, that division has largely been broken down, which is quite incredible. It's really one of the biggest experiments in the world that has succeeded in doing that. Within that, there's still a distinction made between amateur and professional artists. So this huge Aficionados program still continues to this day. Everybody has the right to go and access creative activity after work or after school or whatever, learn to make art, learn to play a musical instrument. And if they have an aptitude for it, they can proceed to the professional ranks. So there is, in theory at least, movement possible between the two realms. At the same time, professional level education is fantastic in Cuba. Many, many fantastic professional artists have come out of Cuba.
So where concretely would one go to participate or enroll in an aficionados program?
Well, in every municipality in Cuba, there are organizations called Casas de Cultura, houses of culture, and everywhere you go, you see them, and they're a kind of nexus of community activity, and so people would go and join their local casa.
So what did Fidel and Che, what did they think about art's role in creating a public and producing a public that could enjoy and engage with art?
Well, the schemes that I've mentioned so far were the very practical steps that were taken to engender a new creative public. And the ideas underwriting this were many. One was that art was a form of social production. It was a valuable tool in creating a new society. Fidel rightly said that art has always been instrumentalized in every age, but the difference is the end to which you put that instrumentalization. And the way that they conceived of culture was as a tool of human happiness. The end product of this social production process would be human happiness as a way of releasing people from alienation, increasing their own liberation. And so that's really how culture was conceived. And at the same time, you have an idea that a revolutionary consciousness had been developed among those who'd fought in the insurrection. But that consciousness didn't necessarily extend through the whole population. And so there was an idea that an engagement in culture would help to engender a population that really tried to understand what was going on around them, made them more self-reflexive, more critical, and able to engage in this new society that was being created. And finally, there was an idea that a sort of side effect of all of this was that economic development would be encouraged as well, because Cuba in the 1950s was hugely underdeveloped, and suddenly a new economy needed to be created in order to sustain the new society. And so putting people's spiritual and cultural development, number one, would have a side effect that people would be engaged in material development as well. The idea was that if you were more educated, more cultured, you could play a more holistic part within society.
When people think about art under communism or socialism, many of them think about art that is propagandistic, that is didactic, that is instrumental in relation to government ideology. To what extent did that conception of art prevail or make any inroads into the Cuban scene?
Well, it's important to remember that when we talk about the revolutionary government in the aftermath of the insurrection, it's not a monolith. It was made up of various different factions. So you have Fidel's 26th of July movement, you also have the former Communist Party, and you have a whole strain of student activity as well. And these different voices were all brought together under the revolutionary banner, and they all had slightly different ideas about how culture could and should be. And within that, you have various individual personalities as well. So there was a huge kind of discussion about these issues. And in 1961... the revolutionary government set up something called the National Council of Culture. Now, I mentioned that the pre-revolutionary Communist Party, had been developing ideas around culture and cultural policy. So it seemed natural and logical to give control of culture to the Communist Party, who'd been dealing with these ideas in the 1950s. But within the Communist Party, there were various tendencies, various opinions about how culture should operate. And unfortunately, there were those on the orthodox wing of the party who felt that they should try and implement some of the ideas that Stalin had been implementing in the Soviet Union, who believed that socialist realism was the way to go. They were very hardline. They proposed that there should be the complete eradication of idealism and its replacement with materialism, and they wouldn't tolerate any forms of abstraction, surrealism, and other morally suspect forms of art in their eyes.
And socialist realism was the officially sanctioned style of art in the USSR beginning, I think, in the 1930s, and that really stressed glorified depictions of the communist future and communist values.
Indeed, yes. The kind of idealization of the worker within society. And very early on, very prominent artists and writers who may or may not have been members of the Communist Party were making very articulate arguments why this shouldn't be allowed to happen in Cuba, because they had the benefit of hindsight by then. It was really the 1934 Literary Congress in the Soviet Union that laid down socialist realism as the official trope of the revolution, and the Cubans had time to see how that played out and wanted nothing to do with it. By and large, the majority felt like that. So very influential voices rejected that way of working, not least Che Guevara, who in 1965 wrote a text called Socialism and Man in Cuba, and he completely rejected the idea of socialist realism as a kind of dead form of art that only functionaries could understand. So the argument was put forward that culture within the revolution should be much more dialectical. There should be a process, a discursive process, in which art forms from around the world should be embraced and critiqued, and the parts that were found to be valuable should be accepted and incorporated into what was happening in Cuba. So it was a huge struggle. It was by no means an easy process, but the idea of art as propaganda has largely been resisted. The idea of this didacticism, this need to convey very literally what was happening within society, was rejected. Of course, there are exceptions to that when we think about educational documentaries that were trying to explain what was happening within revolutionary society. But by and large, the tendency towards much more lateral cultural production was encouraged. And we see that there was an embrace by the revolutionary government over time of work that absorbed the values of revolutionary society and communicated them in whichever way their producers felt fit.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt joins me in studio. She works with the Center for Cultural Change in Kent in the UK, which is an umbrella organization that enables critical and creative researchers to explore alternatives to the current sociocultural malaise in the capitalist West. And she is author of, and we are talking about this book today, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, The Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. It's published by PM Press. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. The book grew out of a dissertation that Rebecca wrote at the University of Strathclyde. So, and I know we're sort of jumping around in terms of time here, but you have Castro and his comrades taking over in 1959. And then in October 1960, there is a meeting of leading artists and writers, which resulted in a manifesto that I think was produced a month later. What's important to know about this meeting and the manifesto that resulted?
Well, one of the most important things to note about this is that when we're thinking about early ideas around culture, they were very much coming up from within the artistic community. So the fact that writers and artists called this meeting in the first place to discuss their role within revolutionary society is highly significant, because it shows a great commitment to the social change that was being enacted around them. And they weren't prepared to allow their fate to be determined by bureaucrats. They wanted to play a very active part in that process. And so in the manifesto, we see that they are aligning themselves very firmly with the revolution. They're supporting the Declaration of Havana, which had just been made. And they're really trying to ponder what their role within that society should be. And out of that meeting came the program for a First National Congress of Writers and Artists, which was held the following August. It had to be postponed because of the Bay of Pigs invasion. It had initially been planned for spring that year. But they dictated their own program. They decided who they would invite to these meetings. And they had an idea that they would want to form an artists' union out of this meeting.
And they did.
And they did.
One really kind of compelling little vignette you present in this book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, relates to Alberto Korda. So he was a photographer and a very prominent one that served Castro. What happened to the work and outlook of Korda because of the Cuban Revolution?
Well, somebody's written a book. Lee Lockwood wrote a book called Castro's Cuba, Cuba's Fidel. And in that, he has an interview, he interviews many people within the revolution. And he describes Korda as having been a very happy-go-lucky hedonist before the revolution, who suddenly had this great moment of a sort of eureka moment in the aftermath of the revolution, partly through his work alongside the revolutionaries as a photographer. And he suddenly realized that he had a role within society, which is a common realization to people who were artists during the 1950s. they had this real sense of social inutility during the 50s, and all of a sudden the doors of imagination are thrown open and everybody has a part to play within society. And it's important not to understate the prestige that was conferred upon artists as having this new role within growing society.
It must have been an incredibly heady atmosphere in the years after the revolution.
Absolutely, yes. And there was a very anti-bureaucratic strain running through the revolution as well. So everything was really done on the fly. There were ideas that were put out there that were very democratic and very anti-elitist, anti-imperialist, but nothing really congealed or consolidated during the early years. And so one of the great writers of Cuba, Ambrosio Fournette, has said that the best years were the years when they didn't have any cultural policy.
Yeah, indeed, because this happens, right? After a while, organizations get set up and bureaucratization proceeds, and there's a kind of effort, would you say, to regularize things and systematize things and regulate things.
Yes, well, it's important to mention that the first two and the most important two cultural institutions that I would define in Cuba, the Film Institute and Casa de las Americas, which is a Pan-American cultural house, those institutions were set up within 2 months of the triumph of the revolution. And so they bypassed any of this bureaucratic stuff that might happen afterwards. So there was a great recognition that new institutions needed to be created very quickly, but unencumbered by the great weight of bureaucracy. And what happened was, in 1961, as we've seen, the National Council of Culture was set up, which is where the bureaucratic machine starts to kick in, because you then have an intermediary between the government and the artists.
And so to some degree, was there kind of a conflict, or was there tension between this National Council of Culture, which was controlled by the what used to be the Cuban Communist Party, which was now the Popular Socialist Party, between that, which kind of represented the bureaucracy and the intermediary, and these two organizations you just mentioned, which tended, it sounded like, to be more grassroots and more spontaneous?
Yes, the organizations I've just mentioned, the New Film Institute and Casa de las Americas, they were very open in their approach, what we might describe as progressive, not very bureaucratic, and very heavily infiltrated by artists and writers. So filmmakers, in fact, in the 1950s, developed the cultural policy that would give rise to the Film Institute. Cultural producers were very instrumental in forming Casa de las Americas, and it became a great nexus for people, and still is today, who are visiting the island, through their literary prize and through a great art collection that they've amassed. And so that did set them at odds to some extent with the new National Council of Culture, but they were by and large protected from bureaucratic influence, mainly through the revolutionary prestige of the two people who led those two organizations. And so they became, during the dark times of the revolution, which we might talk about, they became a place for people to shelter, really. They provided protection for artists against any bureaucratic tendencies. And outside of those institutions, if we think about a clash directly between cultural producers and the new National Council of Culture, that became very evident very soon after it was formed. So in January 1961, you have the new National Council of Culture being set up. Then you have a film was screened on television in the immediate aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was supported by a journal, a literary cultural supplement, that was produced every Monday by the main newspaper. And they commissioned a short film that was screened on television. Everybody had the right to see it because televisions were in most homes in Cuba in those days, and still are. This film was slightly politically ambiguous. If it hadn't happened in the immediate aftermath of the Bay of Pigs invasion, it probably would have gone without comment and it would have attracted wider cinematic distribution. But as things stood, because it was a very politically sensitive time, the island was under siege from CIA-supported militias, it was felt that cinematic distribution should be denied this film. And the artists and writers who'd supported the film saw this as a spectre of Stalinism being projected over the island, and they predicted the total end of culture and were very horrified by this. And so you can see how the debate became polarized very quickly. Now, of course, within that, there are minutiae. There are personal differences between the various protagonists involved in all of these debates. But to cut a very long story short, the magazine that had sponsored the film on television ceased production in November of that year. And there were attempts made within the wider cultural milieu to kind of quell the discontent that had erupted during that time. So in June, there was a series of three meetings held in the National Library in Havana, attempting to resolve these disputes. And at the final of these three meetings, Fidel gave a speech that retrospectively became known as Words to the Intellectuals. And in that, he tried to articulate a very broad basis for cultural production on the island. And the phrase that's most quoted from this speech is, within the revolution, everything, against the revolution, nothing. Which means that as long as you're producing something that fits within the revolution and isn't explicitly counter-revolutionary, then your work will be accommodated. So it was a very open statement. People have deliberately or otherwise misinterpreted that. But for me, it's a very open statement, and it set the pattern and the tone for cultural policy over the next decade.
Does the statement mean that if you produced art that had nothing to do with the revolution but was not counter-revolutionary, that that would be okay?
Yes, absolutely. For me, I like to give the analogy or the kind of contradistinction with George W. Bush's phrase, if you're not with us, you're against us. It was the opposite of that. It was, if you're not against us, you're with us. So it was very inclusive.
Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt, we were talking about her book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution. We'll take a short break and speak more with Rebecca about her really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt has worn many hats over the years. She's worked as a curator at the Nordic Institute for Contemporary Art in Helsinki. She's been a researcher in residence at the Center for Contemporary Art, Derry Londonderry, and a research associate at Arts for Health at Manchester Metropolitan University. And she is currently a researcher and staffer at the Center for Cultural Change in Kent. And her new book is To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution, which examines the Cuban Revolutionary Government's commitment to culture. And the book also, and I'm quoting from it, seeks to isolate the main tenets of Marxist humanist cultural policy as it evolved in Cuba from 1959 onwards. Marxist humanist cultural policy. So what strands of humanism can be found in Marx's thought and writing?
Well, if we think about it from the Cuban perspective and how they interpreted this, the two main ideas were individual liberation and social transformation. And we've seen what kind of an integral part culture plays in the idea around individual liberation. The idea was that by becoming involved in culture, people would have happier lives. That was really the essence of it. And in doing so, they would play a part in overcoming alienation. If we think about social transformation as the other strand of Marxist humanism, as we find it in Cuban cultural policy, we've seen the role that culture plays in societal development through education, through culture, through playing an active part within society, through developing revolutionary consciousness, and possibly also playing a part in material development.
A lot of people would focus, when they think of Marx, on sort of material economic reality and political economy. And you devote a brief section in your book to really identifying where in Marx you can find references to human happiness and self-actualization, and how important it was to Marx that not just the economic, strictly speaking, the economic system be changed, but that people be changed and people be liberated.
Yes, absolutely. And this was very much picked up and run with in Cuba. So there was an idea that obviously it's not a new idea. Lenin advocated it, Gramsci after him, and Che Guevara picked up on this idea of the new Cuban man. Now, that's laden with the kind of gender-specific terminology of the day, but what he meant was the new human subject, and more specifically, perhaps, new human relations, which prioritized involvement in society over material reward, prioritized happiness, prioritized man's liberation and solidarity.
So again, Fidel and his comrades take over in 1959. In 1968, in January 1968, there is a Cultural Congress of Havana. What stands out to you about this pivotal gathering?
One of the main things that stands out, if we think about it in its appropriate historical context, is that Che Guevara had just been assassinated in Bolivia, and his project was very much an attempt to stimulate continental revolution throughout Latin America and beyond. What happens when he's killed is that they lose the major figurehead in the battlefield, but the anti-imperialist ideology then shifts over into the ideological field, with culture being central to that. So at the same time, the United States was very aware that this was going on and tried to quell and disrupt the consensus that was building up in Latin America. There was Robert Kennedy went on television in 1966 to warn the citizens of the United States that continental revolution was coming, whether they liked it or not. So the US really stepped up its activity in the area, trying to disrupt solidarities that were being built. And at the same time, in articulating a position of continental struggle, Cuba was very firmly distinguishing itself from the Soviet Union, which didn't have this policy. And so when the Cultural Congress of Havana was hosted, anti-imperialism was absolutely center stage, and underdevelopment was one of the other main themes. And so Cuba is very much shining a light on its own situation, looking at itself as a country escaping centuries of underdevelopment and calling upon the world's intellectuals to try and help them in this quest. So around 600 of the world's intellectuals came together in Havana, and the onus was put on them to really think about underdevelopment and imperialism and the relationship between the two and the ways in which their work might contribute to dismantling both of those.
And how did the Congress, how did that Congress of 1968, how did that affect the cultural scene on the ground in Cuba?
Well, it put Cuba in a very prominent position on the international stage. And what I find is that when Cuba's enjoying great international prestige, conditions at home flourish. Conversely, when Cuba is closer to the Soviet Union, we find that orthodox voices are emboldened and culture tends to shrink a little bit. At home, some of the ideas that were perpetuated at the Congress became very important. So you see some of the most prominent artists and writers and cultural organizers chairing the different panels that were hosted. There were five different panels within the Cultural Congress, and prominent people took responsibility for each of these and then progressed the ideas that had been discussed by all the intellectuals. So just to take one example, the idea was that looking at cultural imperialism and how that operated, it seemed necessary to both recognize how that happened, but also to develop antibodies, as they described it, against cultural imperialism, which meant being very aware of what was going on and trying to resist and rebuff these advances wherever they were found. So that might mean artists being co-opted by grants or exhibitions or invitations to otherwise participate in things that were happening, for example, in the United States. And artists and writers who had been taking part in that discussion were very attuned to those sorts of ideas and on high alert, and that would carry them through for the next few years. So the ideas that were perpetuated at the Congress really filtered down into Cuban society over the next few years and were expanded upon by the artists and writers.
You referred earlier to the dark years, and I think here you're referring to the years 1971 to 1976, something like that. What happened to Cuban culture and its relationship to this state then?
Well, we can see things starting to darken towards the end of 1968. In August 1968, the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia. And although Fidel was very dismissive of this invasion on Cuban television, he couldn't publicly declare his opposition to it because Cuba was part of the Communist International. And as a result of this failure to explicitly denounce the invasion, Cuba lost a lot of international friends and became rather isolated and was welcomed closer into the Soviet ambit. And as I've said, that tended to embolden orthodox voices. So throughout the late 1960s, you start to see artists being maligned in the press. And everything came to a head in 1971 for a couple of reasons. One is that a poet who was fairly politically ambiguous, having served time in Soviet Union and in Czechoslovakia and developed a rather anti-communist perspective, this poet named Alberto Padilla, he was In 1968, his poetry was honoured by the National Union of Writers and Artists by a jury, an international jury, who decided that his book should win a prize and be published. And at that time, the union published a caveat in the beginning of the book to say that they will publish this book, but they didn't feel it was particularly appropriate to a revolutionary society. So there's a distance being put in place there. There were also a series of articles that came out under a pseudonym in the magazine of the Armed Forces, which similarly denounced Padilla for his political ambiguity, and various other artists as well. In 1971, Padilla was imprisoned over the content of a novel that he was writing, which was similarly politically ambiguous, and this prompted a letter to be addressed to Fidel from many intellectuals from outside of Cuba who had previously been supportive of the revolution, including Jean-Paul Sartre and people who'd visited the island. And this put the revolution in a difficult position because intellectuals from outside had criticised it without really fully understanding the facts on the ground. And in April 1971, a Congress had been organised called the National Congress of Education, and that was hastily converted into the First National Congress of Education and Culture, providing a platform from which the revolutionary leadership could answer the criticisms that had been levelled at them from outside. Fidel took the opportunity to make a speech that castigated a very small minority of intellectuals who'd criticised the revolution from outside without fully understanding what was happening. And again, this lost international friends. It seemed to be something of a rift opening up between Cuba and the international intelligentsia. The CIA was very active in the ideological field, set up something called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which had journals published in many, many different countries and different languages, and they served to exacerbate the rift between Cuba and the international intelligentsia. And what happened in the immediate aftermath of the Congress of April 1971 was that a former army officer who's been suspected of authoring the articles in the Armed Forces magazine was put in control of the National Council of Culture. And he was there from 1971 to the mid-1970s and enacted a huge program of repression, particularly aimed at artists who'd come to maturity before the revolution. And instead, he favoured young artists who were politically naive and tried to almost indoctrinate them into a kind of new way of producing art. And so we see what Ambrosio Fournette has termed the five grey years, spanning from 1971 to 1976. In fact, there are those that argue, probably quite rightly, that the period lasts longer than 5 years, and it was probably much darker than grey. So there are those who like to call it the Black Decade. And during that time, many mistakes were made, and it's now universally acknowledged within Cuba that that is the case, that a wrong turn was taken at that moment. There's been a lot of analysis dedicated to where they went wrong and how they went wrong. And luckily, towards the end of that period, in 1975, the Cuban Communist Party had its first Congress, and it was able to analyse some of the mistakes that were made during that period and put steps in place to cancel out some of those mistakes. And the most obvious step that they took was to dissolve the National Council of Culture and replace it with a Ministry of Culture, which was headed up by Armando Hart, who'd been the first Minister of Education and was a Marxist-humanist philosopher, very closely connected to artists and writers and other people in the kind of progressive bureaucracy.
Rebecca Gordon Nesbitt joins me in studio. She is founder and researcher at the Center for Cultural Change in the UK, and her new book is To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution, which grew out of research she did for her dissertation. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So I wish we had more time, but what's your sense today of the extent to which Cubans and the Cuban government place value in art and see a relationship between art and society and people?
I think it's as integral now as it ever was. The three cornerstones of the revolution are education, health, and culture. And we hear a lot about health and education, but maybe not so much about culture. But it's absolutely vital to the society of Cuba. It's encouraged at every turn. Everywhere you go, you'll see a gallery on every street corner. It's incredibly easy to access culture. One area that we haven't talked about today is film, which was The Film Institute is something I mentioned, but so after the Film Institute was set up in March 1959, very, very soon after the triumph of the revolution, the idea was that a new film industry was needed to be born. As I mentioned, filmmakers had come together in the 50s to think about how that might work and to draw on the indigenous talent that was there and also the subject matter that they found all around them. They were quite influenced by the Italian New Wave and the idea that you would reflect what was going on around you. And so the Film Institute commissioned very many interesting films, initially documentaries, but more lateral and narrative explorations soon started to come out of that. And they were also responsible, and still are, for a network of cinemas around the island. So around 600 cinemas in a small population were built around the island. And for those areas that were more inaccessible, there was a mobile cinema program set up, which would see a young projectionist going around on a truck or being drawn by a donkey, or even in a couple of cases, going around the island by boat to take cinema into the furthest reaches of the island. And even today, it's incredibly easy to get to the cinema. It costs about the same price as an egg. So it really turns on its head the kind of way that we understand the film industry. It took the profit motive out of that and made that very, very accessible. So that's one of the great triumphs of the revolution in terms of culture: the accessibility of film, the accessibility of art, the ability of anybody to get involved in art if that's what they decide to do.
And how would you compare the Cuban revolutionary approach to culture with culture the way it's handled and treated and viewed in the capitalist West?
Well, certainly where I come from, the main value of culture is articulated in economic terms. It's only now, actually, in the past couple of years, that we've started to look in the research field at the individual and social value of culture, which to me is slightly hilarious, given that Cuba has really understood this for more than 50 years now. They, as I've said, they prioritize the individual and social value of culture and considered the economic value as only a byproduct of that process.
And in recent years, art has really been seen as the key to economic recovery, right? Like in the US and in the UK, and Richard Florida came out with his book Through Creative Class. What is your sense of that emphasis and that possibly renewed interest in art and creativity?
Well, I take issue with that, really. I'm not sure that it's very helpful as a construct, or indeed very relevant or easy to prove that there's a connection between culture and regeneration. Florida proposes the idea of the creative city, the idea that there's a creative class that migrates to a particular city, makes it more vibrant, and makes bank headquarters want to relocate there or whatever. I'm not sure how this really plays out in real terms. So we do see culture often implicated in the whole idea of regeneration. But actually, if you look at it closely, we're sitting here not a million miles from places in San Francisco where there's a sort of class cleansing going on, where people who are artists and don't have much money, don't make much money, aren't necessarily supported by the state to make their art, are being eradicated from the city because of this regeneration process. So although artists might be at the first wave of regeneration and are often implicated in that, in beautifying cities or in colonizing new places, what you often find is that once that first wave is over and the developers start to move in, artists are systematically eradicated from those areas. So I really don't hold much faith in Florida's analysis.
You write that many artists and cultural commentators in the West have, in response to state defunding of the arts, advocated a return to the autonomous status of art. Tell us about that and what you think the consequences of that have been or might be.
Yes, well, in the capitalist world, as I've said, there's been a historic divide between art and the people. And if artists reassert their autonomy, what they're effectively saying is that they are relinquishing their social role and widening that gulf between themselves and the people. And so for me, this is part of the root of the problem. The fact that we've lost sight of the social value of art means that we have no arguments to present when our governments ask us what the value of art is and why they should fund it. And it drives art into the hands of the market.
So what do you think the opening up of Cuba to improved relations with the U.S., what do you think that might do to cultural policy as articulated by Raúl Castro and his government?
There are many facets to that question. One is that there is a lot of enthusiasm being directed, at least seemingly in the political sphere, towards Cuba at the moment. In the discussions that I've been to around this subject, people tend to agree that it's a change of tactic rather than a change of policy. So the embargo is still in place. There doesn't seem much movement really around that. So when it comes to money coming into the country, that is through remittances generally from people who have family abroad. And that can create huge disparities within a society like Cuba, because only people who have family abroad have access to that foreign currency. In terms of cultural policy, money can also play a fairly deleterious role. And so what we see is artists have freedom to travel and have freedom to make money from their work. Somehow cultural products are able to maneuver past the blockade. And again, we see inequalities being introduced into society that way. But what I will say is that Cuba's very wise, and their entire process can be defined as a process of trial and error. And so if they see that something is happening as a result of a policy in one area of society, they can very easily rectify that and make compensations or allowances or adjustments, which means that society is rebalanced. And so I have faith in the Cuban people and in the Cuban government to act sensibly and steadily. They've been waiting for this for a very long time. Obviously, the blockade should be lifted, but it doesn't mean that the floodgates of capitalism are going to be opened.
Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt, we have links on againstthegrain.org to her new book, To Defend the Revolution is to Defend Culture, the Cultural Policy of the Cuban Revolution, as well as to the Center for Cultural Change, where she is a staffer and researcher. Rebecca, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time.